Now he was receiving letters nearly every day, only a few of which he felt inclined or obliged to answer. He would ask me to read them, then indicate the lines along which he wanted them answered. I would submit a draft, and we would go over that. Only at Thousand Island Park, when some real recovery had been won, did Swami begin signing his name again, and there he wrote one or two personal letters in his own hand. In our numerous visits to doctors and dentists, we raced up and down the avenues of New York in many a taxicab, I with my eyes shut more often than not. It did not seem to bother Swami. He sat back, apparently content to place his trust in the Lord. Many cab drivers in New York are famous for their conversational talents, tried to guess his nationality, and though it was a matter of pride with them to be able to, not all succeeded. His skin was light, his nose almost a Roman one. One day we were speeding home from the office of a dentist whose name was Slocum, S-L-O-C-U-M. Swami was puzzled by the name, hearing it but not seeing it, and thought of it as Slocum, the Sanskrit word for a scripture verse. So in the taxi he asked me, how did that dentist get a name like that? What language is it? I feel sure, I said, that it doesn't come directly from Sanskrit. That was all I could say. The day Swami had his teeth pulled was a black one. We brought him home and helped him to bed. The dentist had placed a kind of packing in his gum, which he was finding uncomfortable in his mouth. He insisted on trying to remove it. I forgot my place completely, lost my temper, and shouted at him. No, you must not, Swami. The doctor has forbidden it. He forgave me, of course. The dark cloud had its silver lining, for Swami Nikhilananda was present, and it seemed to enhance his confidence in my nursing abilities. It was now time to make a visit to the Vedanta Society on West 71st Street, deferred during the long time Swami Madhavananda's treatments were being carried out. Swami Pavitrananda had been very eager to receive him and to have the devotees meet him. One of them came to pick us up, for I was to go with him. In the ground floor dining room of the center, we were served a magnificent dinner. As dish after dish came through the swinging doors from the kitchen, I noticed that no two were carried by the same person. Evidently, the eagerness to see and serve the former General Secretary of the Order had been keen, and this was the way the problem had been solved. After dinner, 18 or 20 of their inner circle gathered in Swami Pavitrananda's parlor and were invited by him to ask the senior Swami some spiritual questions. It was the first time on this American visit that I had heard him speak at such length on specifically spiritual topics. It was gratifying that even without teeth or full control of his facial muscles, he was able to make himself understood. I managed to record the following sketchy notes. Questioner: is spiritual struggle real or apparent? Swami: so long as a person thinks of himself as an individual, it is real. But if one comes to experience samadhi and the world disappears, then his struggle is seen to be unreal. Question. Then who is liberated? Swami. Whoever it was that felt bound before. Question. Should one remember God when doing things that are not so worthy, like going to a film? Swami. If one can, so much the better. Then that activity will itself change. And also, the Lord will not leave him long in a state where he does such things. Question. Does the language used for God's name matter? Swami. No. If one knows it is God's name, that is the important thing. Question. Is not the natural tendency of the mind to go upward? Swami. Unconsciously, perhaps you might say. Question. Can we exert free will to get beyond causality where we will be free? Swami. Try. The point is, be consistent. Don't use free will in mundane affairs and then put all spiritual matters into the category of God's grace. Question. How can we love incarnations if they are embodiments of the God who created this hell of a world? Laughter all around. Swami. In one aspect he tries to bind us, in another to free us. He plays with us thus. These avatars are the benign aspects, and so they can be loved. Question. Why doesn't the destructive aspect incarnate? Swami. Maybe Hitler or Stalin was some such. But God sees it as we see a play. Question. Will you tell us something about Swami Turiyananda? Swami. Read the books and articles. It is difficult to say much about such people. You may see the beauty of the ocean, but can you write about it like a Tagore or a Tennyson? Those who have vivid memories can recite incidents to support their statements. In our day, we had no such books. We had to depend on memories. I remember one thing which the devotee Nitya Gopal told us Thakur had said about Maharaj, Swami Brahmananda. Rakhal is like a green-looking banana, which is really ripe, and like a flint brought out from underwater. Question, how can one learn not to criticize others without causing too much strain to a beginner? Much laughter followed. Swami, it bespeaks a holier-than-you attitude to have this problem at all. Here is one idea. A person's sins are being washed off onto oneself when one criticizes that person. This is an old and familiar way of thinking to us. On behalf of the Society, Swami was presented with a transistor radio, which, as it happened, was put to good use when he returned to the hospital. Swami had his new dentures in time to eat Thanksgiving dinner, and at the center, a traditionally fine one was prepared. But now he was becoming anxious to return home, and it became more difficult to make Western food attractive to him. Swami Nikhilananda himself, beset with so many other tasks, would go into the kitchen, don an apron, and cook Indian dishes for him. It was his cooking alone that really satisfied him. The weather was cold now, much to his dislike. "It makes men so dependent on trappings," he said, meaning the gloves, muffler, overcoat, and hat, without which New Yorkers simply do not go out in the winter. He did like the drives on which Swami Pavitrananda would take him with his car and driver. One night after dusk, we sat in the car, looking out at the lights of the skyscrapers. Swami Pavitrananda told us a story about Josephine McLeod, the celebrated friend and confidant of Swami Vivekananda. She had been taken to see an exhibit of Edison's new lamps, a brilliant display of electric lighting of that time. Others in the party had been enthusiastic, while she had remarked, "But all this is man-made. It is nothing compared to the beauty of a single sunset." Swami Madhavananda listened to this, "but," he commented, "the beauty of a sunset is gone in a few minutes, whereas this beauty we can go on enjoying for hours." The American Swami and I walked with him to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in Central Park, where a devotee, a graduate student in art history, was waiting for us. It was a much longer walk than usual, but on display there was the renowned Rembrandt painting of Aristotle patting the bust of Homer. Swami Nikhilananda had been talking about it very much, so Swami Madhavananda had conceived a desire to see it for himself. All were discussing the fabulous sum the museum had paid, the most ever for a work of art, $2,300,000. After a guided tour of the museum by the student, we stood in front of this painting for a while, Swami saying nothing. On our return, we reported back to Swami Nikhilananda. Swami Madhavananda told him, pouring on the usual cold water of his inimitable candor, "It is the sale price you are enamored of more than the picture." The two episodes were illustrative, I thought, of the Swami's own strong bent for pragmatism.